I'm thinking now, I never really liked him at all.
How unfortunate. Did you like Whiskey Jack?
Aye, we was the best of friends. Plenty there to like, basically, in both of us. Fed was the odd one out, come to think on it.
And now Whiskey Jack rides among the dead.
Tragic, the verdict. A damned shame.
And you loved him deeply.
So I did. So I did.
But Fiddler is still alive.
Aye.
And you never really liked him.
Just so.
In fact, you love all the dead bridge burners.
Of course I do.
Just not the last one left alive.
Hedge glared, and then slapped the man on the side of the head.
Why am I talking to you? You don't understand nothing.
Off he marched, up to where his company trudged. The verdict drew out a small jar, porcelain and studded jewels. He unscrewed the top, dipped one fingertip in, drew it back and examined it, and then rubbed it across his gums.
Die, he whispered. But I have no intention of dying. Not ever.
Jastara finally found them, up near the head of the Kundril column. It was impressive how Hanavat managed to keep up this pace, the way she waddled with all that extra weight. It was never easy being pregnant. Sick to start, and then hungry all the time, and finally big as a bloated bedarin, until it all ends in excruciating pain. She recalled her first time, going through all that so bright-eyed and flushed, only to lose the damned thing as soon as it came out.
The child did what she had to do, Jastara. Showed you the journey you will know again and again. She did what she had to do, and is now returned to the Black Waters.
But other mothers didn't have to go through that, did they? It was hardly as if Jastara was blessed with a life of greatness, was it?
Married Gaul's favorite son, though, didn't she? That woman has ambitions. If not for herself, then for her get.
Ambitions. That word now dangled like a bedraggled crow from a spear point, a rotted, withered clutch of shredded feathers and old blood.
Watch out for widows. See how she took Gaul in? What are they doing at night when the children are asleep? Hanavat had better beware, especially as vulnerable as she is now, with a child about to drop and her husband fled from her side. No, look hard at that gilk, Widow Jastara.
There were measures of disgust, and they came close and one recoiled, and then they came back a second time and one didn't recoil quite so far. And when they crept back a third time and a fourth, when the hand reached out from the darkness to caress her bared thigh, to probe under the furs, well, sometimes disgust was like a mourner's shroud, suddenly too heavy to wear anymore.
Look hard at her now. You can see it in her eyes.
Comfort a broken man and you take the breaking inside. What woman didn't know that? The cracks spread outward, whispering into everything within reach. It was the curse of drunks and Bayang addicts, and womanizers and sluts. The curse of men who spoiled young boys and girls, their own get sometimes, spoiled them forever. Accusations and proof, and then all that shame, kneeling in the dirt with hands over his eyes, or her eyes, and suddenly all the disgust comes back, only now it tastes familiar. No, more than familiar, it tastes intimate.
Do I feel soiled? Do I dare look into Hanavat's eyes?
The question held her back, not 10 paces behind Gaul's wife.
My mother-in-law. Oh, yes. Look at Jastara now. But you forget, she lost the man she loved. She too was wounded, maybe even broken. Of course, she couldn't show it, couldn't indulge in it, because while wife she may no longer be, mother, she remains. What of me? My pain. His arms are the wrong arms, but the embrace is still warm and strong. His shoulder has taken my tears. What am I to do?
So she held back, and the others looked at her and whispered things to each other.
Her courage has failed her,
murmured Shelamassa. Hanavat sighed.
Perhaps tomorrow, then. I don't know what she thinks she can say, the younger woman said, to make this right. Cast him out is what she should do.
Henavat glanced across at Shelemasa.
So that is what everyone is saying, is it? That hard tone, those hard words. The most plentiful coin, spent so freely, is also the most worthless one.
Shelemasa frowned.
What do you mean? When you are judgmental, all the paint in the world cannot hide the ugliness of your face. The viciousness inside pushes through and twists every feature. I am sorry, Henavat. I was thinking of you. And you would take what you imagine to be my feelings and speak them back to me. You proclaim yourself the warrior at my side, the lion standing firm, to give comfort to me. I understand all that, Shelemasa. Yet what I hear from you, what I see in the eyes of the others, has nothing to do with me. Have I asked for pity? Have I asked for allies in this hidden war? Is there even any war at all? You presume much.
She will not speak to you.
And how brave would you be in her stead? Her father-in-law has seduced her, taken her to his bed, or she him, either way makes no difference. Do you think I do not know my own husband? He is difficult to resist in the best of times, and now, in his pain and his need, well, not a woman or man here could defeat his will. But you see, you are all safe from him, freeing you to cast judgment upon the one woman now in this snare. Not upon my husband, however, for what might that say about me? Do not speak to me of sides in this. There are none. There are but people, people of all sorts, each doing what they can to get by. And if what they do hurts others, Henavat, will you martyr yourself? Will you weep for Jastara, too, who hides every day in his arms? Ah, see how I have stung you? You in your cruel judgment. My husband in his need, Jastara in her weakness. They are one and all acts of selfishness, acts of pushing away. How can you say that? I despise what they've done to you. And it tastes sweet, yes? Listen to me. I too am a widow now, and a mother who has lost her children. Have I need for an embrace? A stolen moment of love? Should I feel hatred for Gaul and Jastara for finding what I cannot?
Shelemasa's expression was appalled. Tears streaked down through the white paint on her face.
Is it not your husband you should look to for that? While he still faces away from me, I cannot. Then he's the coward.
To look into my eyes, Henavat said, is to see all that we once shared and have now lost. It is too much to bear, and not just for my husband. Yes, she added, I carry his last child, and if that child is not his, well, that is for me to know in my heart, but never to be spoken. For now, I have that much. I have what I need to hold on, Shelemasa, and now so does Gaul.
The young woman shook her head.
Then you stand alone, mother. He has taken his son's widow. That is unforgivable.
Better, Shelemasa, much better. You see, Jastara does not deserve your hate. Not those looks, those whispers behind her back. No, instead, to be true sisters to her, you must go to her, comfort her. And when you have done that, when all of you have done that, then I shall go to her and take her into my arms.
Henar Vigolf remembered the day he acquired his first horse. His father, whose shattered hip 5 years earlier had ended his riding days, had limped at his side, using his cane as they made their way out to the pasture. A new herd had been culled from the wild herds of the high mountain plateaus, and 23 of the magnificent beasts now moved restlessly about in the enclosure. The sun was high, shrinking shadows underfoot, and the wind swept steady down the slopes, combing the high grasses, warm and sweet with the flavors of early autumn. Henar was 9 years old.
"Will one see me?" he'd asked his father. "Will one choose me?"
The tall blue rose horse breeder looked down, dark brows rising.
It's that new maid, isn't it? The one with the watermelon tits and wide eyes. From the coast, yes? Filling your head with all sorts of rubbish.
But
there's not a horse in the wide world, Hennar, happy to choose a rider. Not one beast eager to serve. Not one is delighted at being broken, its will beaten down. Are they any different from you or me?
But dogs,
by the black-winged lord, Hennar, dogs are bred to be four-legged slaves. Ever seen a wolf smile? Trust me, you don't want to, ever. They smile right before they lunge for your throat. Never mind dogs.
He pointed with his cane.
Those animals are wild. They have lived in utter freedom. So, see one you like?
That piebald one, off to the left on its own.
His father grunted.
A young stallion, not yet strong enough to contest the ranks. Not bad, Hennar. But I'm, well, surprised. Even from here, one animal stands out, really stands out. You're old enough, have been around me enough too. I would have thought you'd see straight off.
I did, father.
What is it, then? Do you feel you do not deserve the best out there?
Not if it means breaking them.
His father's head had rocked back then, and he'd laughed, loud enough to startle the herd. Recalling that moment of his youth, the huge warrior smiled.
Remember that day, father? I bet you do. And if you could see me now, see the woman walking at my side, why, I can almost hear that beautiful roar of your laughter. One day, father, I will bring her to you, this wild, free woman. We'll step onto that long white road, walk between the trees. They must be big by now, and up through the estate gate. I'll see you standing by the front entrance, like a statue commanding the stone itself. New lines on your face, but that hooked grin still there, in a beard now gone grey. You're leaning on your cane, and I can smell horses, like a flower's heady scent on the air, and that scent will tell me that I've come home. I'll see you studying her, noting her height, her lithe confidence, the boldness in her eyes, and you'll wonder if she's broken me, not the other way round. You can see that, not the other way round, but then you'll look into my eyes and your smile will broaden. And you'll tilt back that majestic head and laugh to the heavens. It will be the sweetest sound in the world. It will be the voice of our triumph, all of us, you, me, her. Father, I do miss you.
Lastara's calloused hand found his own, and he took some of her weight as she leaned one shoulder against him.
Bless Bryce Bedict,
she said under her breath.
Hennar nodded. I suspect a streak of the sentimental in my commander.
Be glad of it, I am.
It was unexpected.
Why? I fought for you, Hennar, not the adjunct, you. He understood.
No, not all that, beloved. All this, where we have found ourselves, and how we have found each other, for that matter.
She looked up at the strangers in the night sky.
So he gives us what time there's left to us. Less sentimental, then, more pity.
You've a dour streak, Hennar. I think I prefer Bryce's sentimental one. Maybe I'll get rid of you and ride back to him.
You'd have to fight Aranecht for him, I should think.
Oh, you're right, and I couldn't do that, wouldn't. I like her far too much. Well then, seems I'm saddled with you. He smiled.
Saddled. Ah.
Hennar.
Yes?
I fear we won't be coming back from this journey.
He nodded, not because he agreed with her, but because he knew what she feared.
We're going to die, she said. In fact, we may not even make it across this desert.
There is that risk.
It's hardly fair.
I had a maid once at the country estate. Watermelon tits and big eyes.
What?
My father is terrible with names, so he came up with, memorable descriptions. Anyway, she used to tell me stories at night, long rambling tales of heroes, loves lost, loves won. She'd make every ending sweet, to make the night's dreams the same, you see.
Just what a child needs,
I suppose. But those stories weren't for me. They were for her. She was from the coast, and she'd left behind a man she loved. This was Lether, don't forget, and her whole community was trapped in the indebted way of life. It's why she came to work for our family. As for the young man, well, he was sent to sea. He was silent for a moment, remembering, and then he said, every night she told me how she wanted her life to turn out, though of course I didn't realize that at the time. But the truth of it was, she wanted that happy ending. She needed to believe in it, for her and for everyone else.
Lestara sighed. What happened to her?
As far as I know, she's still there, at the country estate.
Are you trying to break my heart, Henar?
He shook his head. My father worked the system as best he could, and he was not unkind with his indebted. About a year before I left to train with the Lancers, Watermelon Tits with Big Eyes married the son of one of our horse trainers. My last vision of her, her belly was out to here and those tits were even bigger.
She'd given up on her man from the sea then. Well, probably wise, I suppose. Part of growing up.
Henar eyed her, and then away, out over the rocky landscape. I think about her every now and then. He grinned. I even used to fantasize about her, yes, in the way young men will do. The grin faded. But mostly I see her sitting on the edge of the bed, her hands flying and her eyes getting wider, and in that bed is her own child, a boy, who will dream sweet dreams. And when the lantern is turned down, when she's standing by the door to his room, that's when the tears will run down her cheeks, and she'll remember a young man on the edge of the sea. Lastara's breathing had changed somehow, and her face was hidden from his view. My love? Her reply was muffled.
It's all right. Henar, you keep surprising me, that's all.
We'll survive this, Lastara Yil, he said, and one day I will lead you by the hand up to my father's house, and we'll see him standing there waiting for us, and he will laugh. She looked up, wiping at her cheeks.
Laugh?
There are pleasures in the world, Lestara Yil, that go beyond words. I heard one of those pleasures once, and I will hear it again. I will. Before I reached the lofty position of inexhaustible masturbation that is Demidrek Septak of the Great Temple, Banaskar was saying, I had to follow the same rituals as everyone else, and one of those rituals was to counsel commoners. Who knows why they'd ever seek out a priest of the Autumn Worm, but then the truth of it is, the real and true function of priests of all colors is simply that of listening to a litany of moans, fears, and confessions, all for the betterment of someone's soul. Never could figure out whose, but no matter. He paused. Are you actually listening, adjunct?
It appears that I have little choice, she replied. The glass desert stretched ahead of them. A small flanking troop, scouts, he assumed, was slightly ahead and to the left, north of the vanguard, moving on foot, as was everyone else. But directly before Banaskar and the adjunct, there stretched nothing but a broken plain studded with crystals beneath a ghoulish sky. The ex-priest shrugged.
Now isn't this an interesting turn? Blessed woman, will you hear my tales of mortal woe? Will you give counsel?
The look she cast at him was unreadable, and it occurred to him, an instant later, that it was just as well. He cleared his throat.
Occasionally, one of them would complain about me, or rather, about us sanctimonious shits in these ridiculous robes and whatnot. You know what they'd be so irritated about? I'll tell you. Love, that's what.
A second glance, even briefer than the first one. He nodded.
Precisely. They asked, "You, priest, you with that hand beneath the vestments, what in Hood's name do you know about love? More to the point, what do you know about romance?" You see, most people end up moaning about relationships, more than being poor or lame or sick, more than any other topic you could imagine. Lovers, husbands, wives, strangers, sisters, endless confessions and desires and betrayals and all the rest. That's why the question would eventually come round. Being priests, we'd excused ourselves from the whole mess. Hardly a strong position from which to dispense inane truisms passing as advice. Do you follow me so far, adjunct?
Have you nothing to drink, Beniscar?
He kicked at a cluster of crystals, expecting them to break. They didn't. Cursing in pain under his breath, he hobbled for a few strides.
What did I know about romance? Nothing. But after enough years of listening to every possible iteration on the subject, eventually things start getting clearer.
Do they now?
They do, adjunct. Shall I expound on love and romance?
I'd rather you...
It's actually a mathematical exercise, he said. Romance is the negotiation of possibilities towards that elusive prize called love. There, you see? I wager you expected me to go on and on, didn't you? But I'm done. Done discussing love and romance.
Your description lacks something, Beniscar.
It lacks everything, adjunct. All that confuses and clouds, that makes murky what is in fact both simple and stupidly elegant. Or elegantly stupid, depending on your attitude to the subject.
They continued on, neither speaking, for some time. The clatter and groan of the column behind them was incessant, but apart from a lone burst of laughter a while back, there was none of the ribald songs and chants, the running jests or arguments. While it was true that the adjunct had set a stiff pace, Beniscar knew that these soldiers were hardened enough to think little of it. The quiet was unnerving.
Got a desert to cross. It's cold, and it's not nearly as dark as it should be. And that alien glow whispers down on us. If I listen carefully enough, I can hear words drifting down. In all the languages of the world, but not this world, of course. Some other one, where faces lift hopefully to the heavens. Are you there? They ask, and the sky answers not. While here I walk, here I look up, and I ask, are you there? And down come the voices. Yes, we are here. Just reach. I was a sober priest back then, he said, a serious one. I listened, I counseled.
Eventually she looked over, but said nothing. Fiddler glanced to the right, southward, 40 paces distant, the head of the column, the adjunct. Beside her, the priest. Behind the two of them, a pair of fists. 8 Cundrill youths walked with Fiddler, ushered out from under their mother's skirts. They'd spotted him walking alone and had drawn closer. Curious, maybe, or wanting to be doing something that might be important, scouting, guarding the flank. He didn't send them away. Too many had that lost, hopeful look in their eyes. Dead fathers, brothers, mothers, sisters, massive absences through which winds howled. Now they hovered, flanking him as if he was the column itself. Fiddler was silent, and they'd taken up that silence as if it would make them older. So the only sounds were the stones shifting underfoot, the scuff of moccasins, the thump of his boots, and the grind of the column. He'd seen the map. He knew what lay ahead.
Only the impossible. Without water, we will never leave this desert. Without water, all of her plans die here, and the gods will close like jackals, and then the elder gods will show their hand, and blood will spill. The crippled god will suffer terribly. All the pain and anguish he has known up to now will be nothing but prelude. They will feed on his agony, and they will feed for a long, long time. On your agony, fallen one, you are in the deck of dragons. Your house is sanctified.
If we fail, that decision will prove your gravest error. It will trap you here. It will make suffering your holy writ. Oh, many will flock to you. No one likes to suffer in isolation, and no one likes to suffer for no reason. You will answer both, and make of them an illness of body, of spirit, even as the torturing of your soul goes on and on. I never said I'd like you, fallen one, but then you never said I had to. Not me, not the adjunct, not any of us. You just asked us to do what's right. We said yes, and it's done. But bear in mind, we're mortal, and in this war to come, we're fragile. Among all the players, we're the most vulnerable. Maybe that fits. Maybe it's only right that we should be the ones to raise your standard, fallen one. And ignorant historians will write of us in the guise of knowledge. They will argue over our purpose, the things we sought to do. They will overturn every boulder, every barrow stone, seeking our motives, looking for hints of ambition. They will compose a book of the fallen, and then argue over its significance, in the guise of knowledge, but truly, what will they know, of each of us? From that distance, from that cold, cold distance, you'd have to squint. You'd have to look hard, because we're thin on the ground, so very thin. Children always made him feel awkward. Choices he'd put aside, futures he'd long ago surrendered, and looking at them left him feeling guilty. They were crimes of necessity. Each time I turned away, each time we all did. Whiskey Jack, remember once when we stood on the ramparts at Mock's Hold? Lassine had just stepped out from the shadows. There was a child, some son of some merchant. He was bold. You told him something, Whiskey Jack. Some advice. What was it? I can't recall. I don't even know why I'm remembering any of it. Mothers were looking on from that column. Their eyes were on their children, these young legacies, and would grip tight as talons if they could. But spaces now gape, and the children edge ever closer to them, to fill what has been lost. And the mothers tell themselves it will be enough, it must be enough. Just as I tell you now, fallen one, whatever we manage to do, it will have to be enough. We will bring this book to an end, one way or another. And one more thing, something I only realized today, when I chanced to glance across and see her standing there, moments from signalling the beginning of this march. From the very first, we have lived the tale of the adjunct. First it was Lorne, back in Darujistan, and now it is Tavare Paran. The adjunct never stands in the centre. She stands to one side, always. The truth of that is right there, in her title, which she will not relinquish. So what does it mean? Ah, fallen one, it means this. She will do what she has to do, but your life is not in her hands. I see that now. Fallen one, your life is in the hands of a murderer of Malazan marines and heavies. Your life is in my hands. And soon she will send us on our way. In that Malazan book of the fallen, the historians will write of our suffering, and they will speak of it as the suffering of those who served the cripple god, as something fitting. And for our seeming fanaticism, they will dismiss all that we were and think only of what we achieved or failed to achieve. And in so doing, they will miss the whole fucking point. Fallen one, we are all your children. Chapter 12. Word came, and in the ashes I finally straightened and looked upon those few of my children left standing. The throne of shadows was no more, and out from the twilight flew dragons, filling the air with cries of rage and frustration. I knew then that he had done it. He had cheated them all, but at what cost? I looked at the heaps of corpses, a monstrous high watermark upon this cursed strand. Blood ran in streams down the slope to where crimson-streaked light cascaded, where all the wounds still gaped. Another wave was coming. We could not hold. Down from the forest, at that moment of deepest despair, came a trio of figures. I faced them, and from my ravaged soul there was born hope's glimmer. Excerpt, Book 11, Throne, Scepter and Crown, Rise Harat, Coral Trove. Pithy staggered clear, sheathed in blood. The blistering white of the strand shocked her, tilting and rocking before her eyes. She fell to her knees and then onto her side. She let go of her sword, but the grip clung to her hand a moment longer before sobbing loose. With her other hand she tugged off her helm. The blade cut was a slit scoring right through the dented iron. Strands of bloody hair and the tufted padding of her underhelm filled the gap. She let her head drop back, the terrible sounds of battle fading. Overhead the sky spun, torn fragments of light drifted in the gloom.
Ah, Brev, he warned us. In that way of his, he warned us. Back and forth he walked, drawing and sheathing and drawing that damned sword over and over again. You can think about what's to come. You can try and picture it in your mind. What warriors did, what soldiers walked into. But none of it readies you. None of it.
The screaming seemed far away now. The surge and terrible clatter, the maw of the breach, a mass of blades, spear and sword, knife and axe, and all that mouth did was chew people to bloody bits, those iron fangs clashing and grinding. There was no end to its appetite.
So long as there's more people to shove into it.
Her body felt hot, the sweaty gambeson chafing under her arms. She could smell her own reek.
So we called ourselves captains, did we, Brev? Good at giving orders, good at standing around looking important. There with the prince, with his knot of elite soldiers he now calls his watch. Me and you, Brevity, we were officers in an army of fools.
Blood ran warm to pool in her ears, first the one on the left, then the one on the right. Other sounds were drowned in the deluge.
Is that the ocean I'm hearing? An ocean of blood? Is this, I wonder, the last thing we ever hear? Dear ocean, then, call my soul. I would swim the waters again. Let me swim the waters again.
Something trembled the sands beneath her.
No, they won't quit. They want through, just like he said.
She was no captain. She knew nothing about what being a real captain meant. From that first moment, when the breach opened, when light flared out like a tongue of fire, and all those voices from beyond the barrier ripped through. She saw Yedan Derig marching down to the breach. His watch had been arrayed, positioned as squad leaders in the forward line of Lethary volunteers, and there was withal, moving quickly back up the ravaged slope into the forest.
Word to the Queen of Carcanus. The battle begins.
Pithy's attention returned to the breach.
Stick the mercenaries to the front, in a place where there's no retreat except through your more loyal soldiers. They're there for the loot to come, but loot never held any man or woman. Not for long, not when it all rips open. These Lethary Islanders, they're my people, mine.
She took up her sword as she ran down to that first high berm. The weapon in her hand never felt right. It frightened her, in fact. She dreaded spitting herself as much as she did some snarling enemy's spear thrust. Where was Brevity? Somewhere in the rush.
Where like a kicked-over nest of termites.
Someone was wailing. A mother whose child has just pulled loose from her embrace, has just vanished into the press with a sword and shield, a spear or a pike.
It's a scene of the world, every world. On the other side of the barrier, some mother screams her fear, loses sight of her cherished one.
She stumbled, dropped to one knee, vomited into the crushed bones of the beach. Coughing, spitting, feeling a strange hollowness inside, blossoming outward until it felt as if her brain was attached to nothing, floating free of her body. She could hear a roar, the sound of battle. No, she'd never heard it before, not like this. The flight from the coast back in Lether had been nothing like this. Back then, the voices and the will had come from pain and fear, from broken needs. It had possessed a plaintive timber. Against the discipline of Yedan Derek and his elites, those wretched foes had not stood a chance. This was different. The sound that erupted from the breach was by itself enough to drive the defenders back a step. Triumph and rage, they were through. At last through. And the hated enemy would not stop them, would not even slow them. With the mass of their comrades driving them from behind, with the slashing spear points dropping horizontal before them, the Tistliosan poured from the wound. Pithy forced herself back onto her feet, forced herself forward. She was still floating free, but her vision seemed impossibly sharp. She saw the front line of Lethary lifting bizarrely into the air, saw their heads tilting back, their mouths wide open, lifted on the spears of the enemy. The sword slipped from her hand. Numbed, confused, she spun to retrieve it. Someone collided with her, knocked her down. She coughed on a lungful of dusty sand. Where was her sword? There. She crawled over to it. The grip was gritty, biting into her palm. Pithy wiped at her hand, looked over at the breach. Somehow the Lethary line was still there. They were fighting back. They were holding the Leosan on the berm slope. The press from their own side was vicious, pushing to hold and then pushing to advance. Gaps opened here and there and torn bodies were carried back out, limbs dragging. The two witches were now among the wounded. Each held a dagger in one hand. Pithy watched Squish kneel beside an injured woman, leaning close to examine a wound. With a shake of her head, she slid the knife into the Lethary's chest, straight into her heart, then moved on to the next casualty.
You fucking murderers.
Pulley was stuffing bandages into a hole in a man's side, shouting for stretcher-bearers. A second station for the wounded was forming higher up the strand, where cutters worked to staunch bleeding, stitch gashes and saw off ruined limbs. Nearby was a pit dug into the sand for those severed limbs and for those wounded no one could save.
It's organized. They planned for this. Yes, I remember now. We all planned for this. For what's happening right now.
Pithy scrambled forward again.
They're holding, she gasped. They're holding. Captain!
A boy ran up to her. She'd never seen him before. He was frighteningly thin, with sores crusting his mouth. A Lethary.
Who sent you? She demanded. Corporal Nice of the Watch, right anchor, has been wounded and pulled from the line, sir. The Prince needs you to immediately take up command of those flank squads, sir. Errant's push.
She licked her lips. Her bladder was stinging as if everything it held had turned into acid. She looked down at her sword.
Sir?
The damned boy was staring at her. Those weeping sores around his mouth, the smears on his face. She could see that he was terrified. An orphan whose new family was being killed before his very eyes. He had carried the prince's words. He had found her, done what Yedan had asked of him. He was doing what he was supposed to be doing.
Following orders. Holding on to duty. As desperate as the rest of us. Stop looking at me like that. Lead me through, she said.
And like a boy eager for the beach, he took her hand and led her forward. The smell of the heaving press made her choke. The sweat and spewed vomit, the fear and the shit and the piss. How could anyone fight in this? Pithy almost pulled herself loose from the boy's cold grip. But now hands were pushing at her from behind. Faces lunged close, shouting things. Eyes met her own, filled with pleading. Panic roiled in like a grey, grainy cloud. Her knees found a figure down on all fours. As she struggled to step over him, she looked down. Unwounded by any weapon but terror itself, the realization triggered a surge of fury. She halted and twisted round.
Get up, you worthless pile of shit! They're dying up there, for you! On your feet!
and this time she managed to prise her hand loose from the boy's. Reaching down, she took the man by the hair.
"Stand up! You're with me! Let's go!"
Those close by were watching, staring. She saw things harden in their eyes and wondered what that was about.
"Lead on, lad! Front line, quick! You, soldier, don't even think of pulling back!"
"Listen to me, like I know what I'm doing, like I've done this before."
She heard voices around her now. "Look, captain's here."
"Captain Pithy, see her? There."
"She choked a coward."
"Killed him."
"Pithy killed a coward right in front of my eyes."
"Gods below," she muttered.
The boy glanced back at her as he struggled to push between two leathery men. His eyes were suddenly bright. And then all at once she could see spear points flashing as they rocked up from impacts with shields, lashing out, clashing with swords and Andean pikes. For the first time she caught a glimpse of a Leosan face, long, narrow, stretched. But
errant, they look like the Andii. They look just like them.
White-skinned instead of black-skinned.
Is that it? Is that the only fucking difference?
Those eyes locked on her own, pale blue and frighteningly young, above the struggling press between them. And she saw his fear, his terrible, horrifying fear.
"No," she murmured. "Don't do this. Go back, please."
An axe blade slammed into the side of the Leosan's head. Bones folded in around sundered flesh. Blood sprayed from eye, nose and mouth. The lone visible eye still staring at her suddenly went blank, sightless, and he fell down out of her sight. Pithy moaned, tears rose inside her, her sinuses closed up, forcing her breaths to her mouth. She couldn't get enough air, she could barely see through the blur, and the light was pouring down, mottled by shadows, pouring down and down. A leathery woman reached back and closed a bloody grip on her wrist, pulling her forward.
"Corporal Nice said he'd be back soon, sir."
Was this going to be a conversation? She could see the fighting, right there, almost within reach. Where had the boy gone? Nowhere in sight. Her coward? There, suddenly in the front line and screaming as he brought a shield round to block a savage thrust.
"What happened to him?"
"Captain?"
"Nice, what happened to him?"
"Got a hand cut off, sir. Went to get it scabbed. Said he'd be back soon."
The woman faced front again, raised her voice.
"Captain Pithy's in command!"
No one seemed to heed that announcement. And then Pithy felt the air change, as if her ears had popped. Something seethed up around her and then outward. From nowhere and everywhere there came a roar, and the flank lurched, heaved into the face of the Leosan front. As if caught in a current, Pithy was pulled forward. She stepped on something that rolled underfoot, looked down. The boy stared up at her, but no, he was staring up at nothing. Around his gaping mouth, the sores were black with dirt.
"No, clean those up."
And then the bodies underfoot were Leosan, twisted, curled round welters of blood and gaping wounds, broken spear shafts, soiled clothing, empty faces. She could hear other roars, and she knew, that the entire leathery line was driving forward, one section after another.
"Go back to your hole, you poor miserable dogs! Go back!" she shouted. "Back! This is ours! This is ours!"
And all at once that cry was taken up. She saw the Leosan reel before it, saw the enemy ranks buckling as the leathery surged into them again and again. A sudden gap before her, a Leosan settling on one knee, one shoulder sliced open, down through the joint, the arm hanging. Seeing her, he struggled to rise. He was old, his face lined, and the look in his eyes was bleak. Pithy's sword swing was awkward, but all of her strength was behind it. She clipped the edge of his jaw before the blade cut deep into his neck. Blood spurted, gushed all over her. Shocked by the hot deluge, she stepped back. And that one step saved her life. A spear thrust caught her head, bit into her helm. She felt the blade edge cut into her scalp, grind along the bone of her skull, and then she was pulled away. A burly man dragged her close.
"Never mind that. You still got your head, don't you? Seen my sword? He asked. I dropped the fucker. You'll know it 'cause it's still in my hand. Never mind.
He bent down and came up with a woodcutter's axe.
Errant's horse-humped earhole. What the fuck is this? Never mind. To the back line with you, Captain Pithy. I started this and I mean to finish it up.
Nice? Never mind, nice? Is that what they call you?
This is ours!
The chant went on and on. Hands took hold of her. She was being pulled out. Her first engagement against the Leosan. Her first taste of everything. The slaughter, the hurt, the anger, the falling light.
All of it. All of it. Oh, gods, all of it.
Suddenly she stumbled clear. Winced at the blinding glare of the strand as tendrils of agonizing light writhed overhead. Down onto her knees, down onto her side. Sword and helmet away, sounds dimming, fading. Someone drove a pair of knees against her left hip. Blinking, she looked up at Squish, saw the knife in the witch's gore-drenched left hand.
Don't even think it,
Pithy said in a growl. The witch grinned, then was gone. The last end of the rout, a scattering of Leosan, converging as they dragged wounded comrades back through the breach, vanishing into blinding light. Yedan Derig's sword was unaccountably heavy in his hand, so he let the tip crunch down into the soaked strand.
Prince! Address that front line, Sergeant! Get our wounded and dead out of there!
He glared at the breach, the blackened, weeping Mar in Lightfall. Too damaged to do anything as miraculous as heal before his eyes, but the first probe of the enemy had been denied. The Leosan had taken as many of their dead and dying with them as they could, but there were still scores and scores, bodies heaped up at the base of the first berm.
Get a crew to start piling them up against the breach. Make a wall, but tell them to be careful. Make sure the fallen are actually dead or near enough as to make no difference. Yes, sir.
He lifted his gaze as a shadow crossed the lightfall, just above the wound, bared his teeth. A new voice spoke beside him.
That was closer than I liked, Prince.
He turned.
Bedak, was it you behind that last push?
Far right flank, the woman said.
Nice? Could have sworn that was a woman's shout.
Nice got his hand chopped off. Didn't bleed out, thankfully. Captain Pithy took that flank command, sire. Nice made it back in time to drive a wood axe into the skull of one of the last Leosan on that side. Hard enough to break the handle.
Yedan frowned.
What's a wood axe doing in our ranks? My orders on weapon choices were clear enough. That reminds me. Sergeant, collect up the better Leosan weapons, will you?
Got plans with your trophy, Prince?
What trophy?
She nodded down at his sword. He glanced at it. A Leosan head was impaled on the blade, from the top of the skull down and out through the neck, which had already been half severed. He grunted.
No wonder it felt heavy.
Yan Tovis stood at the forest verge, watching them dragging bodies clear, watching others tossing limbs and rolling corpses into the pit. None of it seemed real. The triumphant and suddenly exhausted leathery ranks along the berm were settling to catch their breaths, to check on weapons and armor, to take the skins of water from the youths now threading through the ranks.
They think they've won.
Without Yedan and his watch, that front line would have quickly crumpled. Instead, the survivors now felt bold, filled to bursting. In this one clash, something had been tempered. She knew what she was seeing. A fighting force cannot be simply assembled. It needed that brutal forge, and it needed all its fires quenched in the blood of battle. Her brother was making something here. But it would not be enough. She could see how her own sheikh were looking on, no different from Yan Tovis herself. Yedan was not about to expend the leathery ranks as if they were useless skirmishers, not with what he'd now made of them. He would pull them back, holding them in reserve during the next battle.
They probed to test our mettle. Next time, we will see their true fury. And if that beachhead is established,
then the first dragon will come through. Her sheikh watched, yes, and thought about their own time to come, their own stand against the Liosan. Few of the Lethari were trained as soldiers, and that was no different from the sheikh, but Yedan's watch would be there, solid as standing stones. Until they start falling, they can only do so much. They're Yedan's most precious resource, but he must risk them each time. And as they begin to fall, why, he'll have a new crop of veterans to draw upon. These very Lethari here, and then from among our own sheikh. It's so very logical. But, dear brother, it's what you do best, isn't it? How can I kneel to this? By doing so, do I not make it all inevitable? No, that I will not do. But I will take my place among my people, on that berm. I know how to fight. I might not be Yedan's equal in that, but I'm damned close. It's carved into the souls of the royal line, to stand here upon the first shore, to stand here and to die. They were stacking Liosan corpses, making a wall across the breach. The contempt of that gesture was as calculated as everything else Yedan did. Rage is the enemy. Beware that, Liosan. He will make your rage your downfall if he can. You cannot make my brother angry. He's not like you. He's not like any of us. And his army will follow his lead. They will look to him and take inside what he gives. It's cold, lifeless. They'll take it in and it will change them all. Your army, brother, my people, I can't win this, but neither can you. She collected her sword belt from the stump of a felled tree, strapped it on, settled the helm on her head and fastened the clasp, tugged on her gauntlets. Her people took note. They faced her now and watched as their queen prepared to fight. But what are they thinking? Why do they even look to us? My brother, me, see where our love for them has taken them. See all those limp, lifeless bodies tumbling into the pit. They watched this calm, silent woman readying for battle. They didn't know, of course, about all the howling going on in her head, the anguished screams and the poisoned helplessness eating at every hidden edge. No, they knew nothing about any of that. She saw her brother, gesturing, giving orders. He turned then, and across the distance he faced her. Should she lift a hand, acknowledge his achievement, this first triumph? Should she draw her sword, perhaps, and lift it high? Would he respond in kind? Not a chance. But then, look at me. We see each other, yes, and neither of us does a thing to reach across. How can we? We are co-conspirators in the slaughter of all these people. Yan Tovis turned, found one of her messengers. Arras, deliver the news to Queen Drukorlat. The breach was repelled, acceptable losses. We await their next attack. The young girl bowed and then hurried off into the forest. When Twilight looked back down to the strand, her brother was nowhere in sight. It was now a road of sorts, the white dust soaked in blood, churned into reddish-brown mud, straight as a spear shaft between Serranus' wedding gate and the breach. Shivering, Aparal Forge watched the wagons burdened with the wounded drawing closer. To either side of the narrow track, the massed legions prepared for the real assault. Heads turned to watch the broken remnants of the forlorn hope file past. Well, that was proof enough, was it not? Carcanus was occupied once more. The infernal sheikh had returned, or someone much like them, and were determined to contest the breach. Madness, all of it. Glancing up, he saw 4 of the 13 still veered, their vast wings flashing gold in the ceaseless light. The draconian blood had finally taken them, he knew. They had surrendered forever to the chaos. Among them was Ipath Erul, who had once been a friend.
Son of light, he whispered. Beware your chosen, now that the blood of the Elaint rises to drown all that we once were.
The door behind him swung open, cracking against the stone wall. Aparal flinched, but did not turn round.
If you had followed, brother.
But I did, son of light.
Kadagar Fant swore, was suddenly beside Aparal, hands settling on the alabaster merlon.
That last pass. We were almost through. See my children still on the wing? Where are the others?
Lord, the mane of chaos frightens them. If they surrender to it for too long, son of light, you could lose control of them.
When I am veered, they will comprehend my power, my domination. What more is needed to bend them to my will? Do you truly believe that I do not understand the nature of the Alaint?
The risk, Lord.
It frightens you, does it, brother?
I fear we might lose control of our own people, Lord, and not through any flaw in our purpose or leadership. Iparth Erul and his sisters no longer assemble. The blood of the Alaint has taken them. It has stolen their minds. When they cease to be Tist Leosan, how soon before our cause becomes meaningless? How soon before they find their own ambitions?
Kadagar Fant said nothing for some time. Then he leaned forward over the wall and looked straight down.
It has been some time, he said in a musing tone, since we last set a traitor upon the White Wall. Brother, do you think my people begin to forget? Must I remind them again?
Aparal Forge thought about it.
If you feel it necessary, Lord.
He held his gaze on the column crawling towards the wedding gate.
This is new,
the Son of Light said.
Lord,
I see no answering fear in you, brother.
The mane of chaos, you fool. It devours fear like bloody meat. I am as ever your servant, Lord.
So much so, I now see, that you would risk your own life to speak your mind.
Perhaps, as I once did long ago, when we were different people, not yet who we are now. If so, then I will add this. The day you cease to hear me will be the day that we will have lost.
Kadagar's voice was so quiet that Aparal barely made out what he was saying.
Are you that important, brother?
I am now, Lord.
Why?
Because I am the last among your people to whom you still listen, Lord. You look down upon this cursed wall, and what do you see? Brave warriors who disagreed with you, the rotting remnants of our priesthood.
Kadagar whispered.
They opposed the path of the Alaint.
They did, Lord, and now they are dead, and 4 of the 13 will not return.
I can command them.
As it pleases them to appear loyal, so that shall remain, Lord.
Veiled eyes lifted to meet his gaze.
You draw close, Brother Aparal Forge, so very close.
If my counsel is treason, then condemn me, Lord. But you will not see fear, not in me, not any more, and never again.
Kadagar Fant snarled and then said,
There is not time for this. The legions are ready, and I need you down there commanding the assault. The enemy beyond the breach was surprisingly weak.
Weak, Lord?
I will accept bold words from you, brother, but not outright rudeness.
Sorry, Lord.
Weak. Indeed, it seems they are not even true sheik, devoid of Tist blood entirely. It is my thought that they are mercenaries, hired because the Andii now in Carcanus are too few to personally oppose us. In fact, I now believe that the sheik are no more, gone like a nightmare before the dawn.
They fought surprisingly well for mercenaries, Lord.
Humans are like that, brother. Decide on something and there's no moving them. You have to cut down every last one of them, until not one is left breathing.
The surest way to win an argument,
Aparal commented. Kadagar reached over and gripped his upper arm.
Better. Return to the living, old friend. Today we shall gain the shore. Tonight we shall dine in the high palace of Carcanus.
Lord, may I descend to take command of the legions?
Go, brother. You shall see me soon enough, flying above you.
Aperal hesitated.
Lord, might I speak one last word of advice?
Kadagar's face clouded, but he nodded.
Do not be the first of our 13 through the breach. Leave that to Ipath Erul, or one of his sisters.
But why?
Because the enemy knows that we are here. Soul taken or true Elaint, they will have plans to deal with our eventual arrival, Lord. Use Erul to discover it. We cannot risk losing you, Son of Light.
Kadagar's pale eyes searched his, and then he smiled.
Friend, it shall be as you say. Go now.
Father Light, is this what you want? What was in your mind when you walked out from the city, through the gate that would be named for the day of your wedding, for your procession's path into the realm of dark? Did you ever imagine that you would bring about the end of the world? Take the scepter in hand. Walk to the throne. There is an old saying, every crown leaves a circle of blood. I always wondered what it meant. Where was that circle? Surrounding the one now ruling, or closer still, like razors against the brow?
Aperal Forge walked along one verge of the blood path. He could have veered into his dragon form. He could have wheeled out from the high wall and in moments settled before the breach, those old scattered stones of the toppled edifice with all the joyous carvings. But what would that be saying to his warriors?
You are indeed led by dragons, by the blood-tainted, by the devourers of Kesselbahn.
But was he not Tist Leosan?
I am. For now, for as long as I can hold on. And I'd rather show them that. I'd rather they see me here walking.
The soldiers were ready. He could see as much. He sought to draw strength from them, reassurance, all the confidence he would need to in turn command them. As they in turn did when seeing him.
I must speak to them. Fashion words. What shall I say? Mercenaries await us, humans. They can be broken, for their will has been bought. And if it is to be something to bargain with, like a comforting robe, then that will cannot be worth much when all comfort vanishes. No, make it simpler. Tell them that coin cannot purchase righteousness. Against our will, the humans shall falter. We must simply push hard enough for long enough. Speak with confidence, yes. And then I will think of love's lost, to empty out all the places inside me, ready to be filled with fury and desire.
The Leosan knew enough about humans. Through the piercing of the veil, such as a priest or mage occasionally achieved, they had ventured into human worlds. Testing the notions of justice, as one old scout had once said. Small parties of aimless purpose or singular intent. Journeying often enough for these explorers to return with knowledge of the strange, weak, but profligate human creatures. Short-lived and truncated of thought. Incapable of planning ahead beyond a few years at most, and more commonly barely capable of thinking past a mere stretch of days. There were always exceptions, of course, great leaders, visionaries, tyrants. But even among them, the legacy they sought was more often than not a selfish one, the private glory of immortal notoriety or fame. Pathetic. As he approached the breach, Aperal wondered whether there was a great leader among these humans, these mercenaries. It was, of course, possible, but he doubted it. The once glorious gate had been shattered long ago. It had commemorated a marriage that had spilled more blood than could be imagined.
Shattered 3 civilizations. Destroyed an entire realm. Father Light, could you but have known, would you have turned away?
Would you have sacrificed your happiness for the sake of your people and hers?